going to suggest that if engineers have a problem, other scientists, other trades have problems too. And one of the particular problems is the rushing to understand human practice in a kind of scientific way. And one of the problems that happens sometimes is that the thing that's being sought for, the thing that's being grasped with the imagination of analysis, if you like, slips from you. And I'm going to try and persuade you that nevertheless, we have some insights that are worth, maybe I'm sorry, get used to my body rhythm here, worth commenting on. And I'm going to start with something a little bit banal. I am now the grand old age of 51, and a long time ago, when I left home, as I walked out the door when I was 18 to go to Manchester University, and up the lawn, my mother called out to me, "Don't forget to write home." Now, this was slightly perplexing to me, because she said this to me as if lots of letters came home. Well, I never saw any letters arriving on my mother's or anyone's house, except occasionally for my big sister, who got, I presume, the occasional love letter. But in any case, I wasn't leaving home so as to write to my mother. I wasn't leaving home so as to stay in touch. It seemed to be the weirdest call to a young boy, a bit timid, but looking forward to escape, that someone he's escaping to said, "Don't forget to write home." Now, I want to come back and sort of reflect on that. What was she seeking? What was she hoping? What was she expecting me somehow to be like the little boy that presumably she loved, and not that big spotty, awkward kind of teenager skulking out the front door that actually left? Was she imagining that a written letter from me would evoke that boy she loved, not the one she left go? Was she thinking, for example, perhaps with some kind of communication, the presence of me would be there in the house, and the presence of her? I'm not sure. But what I would also say is, now I'm 51, one of the things I say, and John mentioned it this week, that I now work for the evil empire. When I was asked to come back here, we'll be there again, in fact, I had a big problem. Because for me, the biggest measure was not whom I communicated with, as it were, my web of life. It was the fact that I've only made 41 miles. Now, what does that mean? It means I've made 41 miles from that front door. And at 50, when I was, 48 when I was asked to come back here, that seemed a feeble measure of life. Now, that seems a kind of banal way of thinking about things, but what I want to set out is go through a kind of sets of conundrums. I want to talk not about why we communicate at first. I want to end up with that as the answer. Okay? I'll talk a little bit about this now, and I'm going to explore some ways of thinking about people, partly alluded to in my brief remarks about my mother and my reactions to her. And then I'm going to use some examples. We talked a little bit about letter writing studies, not my own letter writing. Some toys. I bought some toys from Glanson to remake. Probably won't get to talk about that. And I'll end up there. Hopefully, John wants me to finish in half an hour.
Well, a bit longer.
Okay. One of the things he noticed about the age of information overload is distraction. But actually, I bless him, John's not being distracted. He's actually making notes. when I was decided to draft this book, sketch this book, my other half, who I've written most of my stuff, best stuff with, was away at a conference. So I had some sort of peace. At least no one was in my office, no one was around with me. And yet, I was flooded with communications and also vexed by visitors at Microsoft, so we were overloaded. And I thought, God, I hear this argument all the time. But actually, if you looked at the data, what you find then, two or three years ago, that in Microsoft, we on average get about 120 emails each. It seems like quite a lot, doesn't it? We instant message, a new version of Instant Messenger, with Link, some of you will be playing with. We get phone calls. Even when you get more senior, you suddenly get headed letters you never used to. So you get this cycle of no one writing to you. You do get this one really common one from someone in Windsor, so funny. But there we go. And you get people receiving all these things, and my colleagues saying too much already. And then more generally, there's a kind of leitmotif of popular culture that complaining about information overload. So here's a quick list from old ones like Kavanagh, slightly weirdly superficial. She kind of says, everyone's overloaded, and here's your solution. You feel, hold on, tell me a bit more about what this overloaded bit might be. And then you get people like Shirley Turkle. I don't know if any of you read her kind of latest stuff. She seems to be able to say things confidently without actually examining too much whether that might be the case. So currently her case says that if you're instant messaging, if you're on a Facebook and you have 100 friends, therefore your soul must be fragmented 100 ways. If you're instant messaging, you must only have something little left, or be only something little. So her concern is that we must be less because we communicate so little, so much, so often. And then you get people like Gergen, who's a fantastic curmudgeon, hopefully I'll never become like him, who writes that in the 18th century we had an idea that human nature had an essential thing to kind of Rousseau-esque notion of the romantic soul, that's an inner essence, and you needed to discover it and express it. And he says that's just metaphysics. Today we have a new metaphysics, and the new metaphysics is, or are, that we only are what we express. We are only communication facts, and therefore, he says, we should abandon the idea that they have anything inside. All you are is what you do publicly when you communicate. Seems to me these, I mean, I think that's kind of an extreme argument, but anyway, these are the kinds of arguments that you see. That's the kind of context in which we do things. But what do we do? What do my colleagues do? What do I do? John, I do this. I sit with my colleagues and complain and whinge about communications overload at coffee. We have a nice coffee room. I think John's been there. And then what do? When I go back to my office? Facebook, blog, Twitter accounts. And I get paid and have this year before invention payments for communications technologies. What's going on there? So on the one hand, I happily agree that I have too many messages, happily whinge about the world, at work and at home, and yet I'm creating the very technology which seems to be the source of my complaints. So, a few conundrums. Do we communicate more? My mother was saying write to me, but I don't remember any letters. Why do we seem to be delighting in new channels yet whinging about the old ones? Is it because the old ones are no good? Is it because the electric wok is fantastically more efficient and makes for a better Chinese dish than the fire-based wok, the cast iron one? Anyway, what about these things? More messages, or some people talk about, oh, it's just I feel obliged to. So why are they obliged more because there's more messages, or more because some messages oblige them more? Yep, these are sorts of paradoxes, aren't they? This one, fragmentation, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Fragmentation of attention, you know, I try and write. Today I've had one of those days where I've done nothing, and I blame the messaging, but I think it's probably because it's a muggy day and I've been just a bit useless today. So, why don't we do some counting? Writing, used to be an age of writing? Let's look at this. There's some little explorations. Right, you're not meant to see this. Okay, it's in the book. But one of the things we thought we might do, well, if I'm looking at communications overload, well, let's measure now, let's measure the past. My mother evoked this idea in 1978. Was it the case that there was a time, my mother was alluding to, when people did write lots of letters, and that I was on that weird interregnum between paper and ink and the digital? I mean, when I got to university, there were Atari computers on the desktop beginning to appear, so people were discovering email. So maybe I was in the intervention. But as it happens, if you look at letter volumes, say, and if you take, for example, 1910, just before First World War, and imagine this was the heyday of the articulate Edwardian family, where one imagines that they would spend some time crafting beautifully exquisite inked letters. No, they didn't. This is the total number of letters received per year per person. And you can further unpack this a little bit. But basically, maybe two or three letters a week. And that includes all types of letters. There never has been a letter age. We have this idea that people are writing less and sending less letters. Well, they never wrote anyway. So where do these ideas come from? Why do we think that? What was my mother thinking? So, what about now? If you look at the data, there's loads of data, replete with data. Think of Ofcom, for example. They produce vast numbers of information, and you've got millions of SMSs are sent, millions of hours spent logged on to Facebook, If you look at what people are doing at the computer, especially at home, actually what they're doing is not family finance, it's keeping in touch.
So it would appear. But the trouble is, if you look at those things, although the efforts are up enormously, it's extremely difficult to unpack it in any helpful or sensible way. So, if you take my case, it is true to say that if you divide the total number of emails per capita to Microsoft, it turns out to be about 120 a day. But if you try and unpack it a little bit further without doing things like invading people's privacy, it turns out that this dude, Bill Gates, gets about 3,000 a day. And I get about 40 to 70. And it varies. Now, why does Bill Gates get 3,000 a day? Is it because he's busier than me? Well, he probably is busier than me. But most of the messages are things like, capitalism is evil and you're the root of it. Oh, capitalism is very successful. Can you pay for my charity? In other words, he is the focus of all sorts of people's attention, whether they have relationships with him at all. It's no wonder he gets 2,000. Perhaps for more surprising, he doesn't get more. So, in a sort of perambulation around the topics, counting is appeals, but actually it's quite difficult to make any sensible counts. For all sorts of reasons. I'm going to go on much more prolixly in the book. As John will show you. So, let's think about it a different sort of way. Time. Is it the case that, for example, we have communications overload now because we have less time to communicate? Whereas with Edwardian, say, in 1910, they didn't write so many letters. Were they so benighted in their lifestyle that they had lots of time to do whatever scribbling they wanted? One of the arguments one often hears is we're so much busier these days. Doing things. Well, how are things? What can you say about those sorts of things? Well, as it happens, I've just deliberately cropped here vast sets of data from the time measures, including the government and various other people, that break down data, the things that we're doing today, in the most incredible detail. But that's what you find. Where do you find some things?
Surfeits
of data. That's perhaps things which we know, which are half an hour. It turns out that we work less than people in 1910. We work much less than people in some. We do less work. But there's an exception to this, which is, of course, some rancor in this particular literature, which is that most people work less, particularly so-called blue-collar workers. But white-collar workers, which one might loosely say are the folks listening here and me, we work longer hours. We work longer hours for all sorts of reasons, but one consequence of that argument might be to say that if you've got a PhD, you don't go home so often. This, of course, lots of kind of curious arguments. But anyway, that's more interesting than lots of other things you find about ordinary life. That although the professionals might legitimately claim that they work longer hours than other class of workers. Actually, most properties within an ordinary life haven't really changed since the 19th century. And some of the reasons are obvious. Like getting your body ready takes up most of your time. And by getting ready, I mean letting it rest, cleaning it up, making it presentable, polishing it, buffing it. It takes a lot of time. And then you have meals, just keeping it going, just as a steam engine, it needs coal and water, well, so does your body. And then you have things like, well, not only do you have to look after yourself, we have to look after your house and all this stuff. Things like travel, the volume of time spent travelling hasn't changed for over 100 years. The world doesn't seem to change so much. Now, this is a big slack of time here, 23%. Sounds like quite a lot of things that are going on in there, possibly. One of the problems here is that what the time measures, if you want the phrase, called polychronicity. And although they're very happy at the data they have, one of the things they'll admit is that if you added all that data, a typical day is, I think, 34 hours long. And what they find is, it's perfectly understandable, if you ask a family, and they do have surveys in households, and households get money for this, to keep minute-by-minute lists of what they do, well, when you're watching the telly, you don't necessarily remember that you had a nap with your best mate or your Facebooking and things like that. You just say, I watched the telly, then I had a few phone calls. And you pass up your life, and it looks nice, and it looks good in the reports. The one consequence is
that these time measurers can't capture, if you like, the chaos, the mingling things together. And they whinge about it. They whinge all sorts of reasons, but this is their primary whinge. The other main whinge is that the evidence doesn't seem to think to suggest that the world's changing in ways they expect it to. But perhaps, more certainly back to the theme, who's complaining about things like lack of overtime? Who's complaining about communications overload? Teenagers? The ones who seem to be spending most of their time on Facebook? I come home, Abigail, my wife, could assert this. I walk in, and what do I find my teenage daughter doing? She's lying on the couch, she has the telly on, and she's Facebooking. Get off Facebook. She's not saying, I don't have enough time to do Facebook. She's not saying, I spend too much time on Facebook. She wants to be on Facebook. She doesn't have a problem. Who is the people who are whinging about these sorts of things? Is it that people are on Twitter? Is it that people are on Facebook? Is it that people are emailing all the time? No. But there are people, us, who whinge about these things. We're whinging about going home to do a little bit of email, being on Facebook, but we're not the ones who are doing it in large volumes. How strange is that? Okay, so let's think about it another way. We're kind of circling around sorts of issues. I pointed to the possibility that there might be a question of who. Who's doing the whinging? And one of the things I've suggested is that middle-aged dudes like me whinging about teenagers who are full of life and enjoying connectivity. Right? Now, if you read, for example, Clay Shirky is the doyen, is the dude of social age communication. And if you read, not his current book, but his previous book, what do you say about the person who's doing the communication, the one whose life has changed, who's created a new civilization? Well, there are only three words I could find in that book which said anything about the persons that might be revolutionising themselves through being communicated, joining the communication state, social computing. And they are vanity. People communicate because they'd like to be listened to. Well, that seems perfectly reasonable. We're all a bit vain. People like to natter. Well, that seems reasonable too, doesn't it? Of course we'd like to natter. And then people sometimes are virtuous, will give information, for example, put it on Wikipedia, or help other people who ask for favours. And you feel like saying, how can anyone disagree with that? But what a pallid vision of someone who claims to be understanding and mapping out our new age of connection. When all they say about the people doing the connecting is that they're vain, convivial, and virtuous. Are we not more than that? My opening gambit, the first time, was about banality. I wonder where the banality might lie sometimes. In sociology, my home trade, Castells, Emmanuel Castells, is the kingpin of contemporary sociology. Not people who used to be here, but students. And what is he saying in his series of books on the network society? Nothing that will explain to anybody why anyone would say hello in a social network. What he does say is, if you have mutual interests, you must therefore work together, that your society must be altered because you have some affinity of interest. But why would you say hello? Why do you say goodbye? Why would you get vexed? Why would you communicate? What is it you're doing? No answers to these sorts of questions. So, in science, what's the metaphor there? Now, let me do a little trick here, if I can. Easiest to do this one. I'll close it, please. In science, sorry, I haven't got going yet. I'm going to have to get my mouse over there. There's another way of thinking about the human. And here's a vision from the past, a vision which should be a bit shocking in some ways, but actually is a very good representation of a commonplace approach in science today. As you can see, it's black and white, so it gives just a little fairly old. It starts abruptly. Don't worry.
Immersive atmosphere and the interest in ideas. But their work isn't all guesswork, as shown by this experiment on the attention span needed for safe driving. The experimenter is a ranch director, psychologist John Senders.
Driving along a section of Route 128, and I'm trying to get NAS of the demand driver by this particular section of road. The speed of the car is constant, and as the road varies from moment to moment in the demand that it makes upon me, I must look more often or less often, as the case may be. The visor completely occludes my view during the period that it's down, and I must rely on some stored image or memory what the road was before the visor went down. The half-second look that I have is enough to store all the information that I should need in order to drive down the road. The records that we get of the time between looks at the road give us a direct measure of the difficulty presented to the driver by the road from moment to moment as we drive down it. The shorter the interval between looks, the more difficult that segment of road is to drive. On those periods, as you saw, where the interval was very long, the road was indeed easy. The interval then gives us a direct and quantitative measure of this rather elusive thing called difficulty.
Let me just explain what he's doing there before I try and link it back into my head. This is a real person driving in Boston, in Massachusetts, on a real motorway, not telling anybody else that he's doing it. And he has not only a TV crew with him, but he actually had taxi drivers doing this for real. And I think on their left foot, they have a pedal. And when you have to see, you press the pedal. When you don't have to see, you don't press the pedal. And what he was wanting to do was, as you were driving along a freeway, between junctions, you didn't have to see much. So you kept your foot down a lot so that the thing was down. When you came to a junction, you had to see more, so you pressed more. And his argument was that the visual processing of information could be modelled. And you could model the degrees with which people needed to see to the kind of information inputs that they have and need to process. And that on that basis, you can then model how people process information as information processing machines, loosely speaking. Now, if that's the case, you feel like saying that there might be some analogues to... to information overload, to the problem, if you like, that we're dealing with here. So, that approach, I'm critical of that approach, I'm suggesting perhaps it's not necessarily the approach you might want to use for some of the questions I've proposed, is very good for things like auditory input, tactile input, output, perhaps more difficult. A lot of my world adapts that. So when you're looking at the design of the latest version of Office 10, for example, what they're interested in is not the content of a Word document, but how quickly you can create it, how quickly you can read it, for example. Now, communication between people, is that a processing problem? Well, John would have been taught Shannon and Weaver. He may never have read Shannon and Weaver, but you were diligent there, diligent enough. If you read Shannon and Weaver, particularly this gentleman, his argument is emphatically information processing does let you understand communication between people, meaning, even though Shannon's opening gambit was that semantics was not the topic of his work. Does everyone know who Shannon and Weaver is? Shannon basically devised a mathematical concept for modelling information. And the idea was that he argued, the crucial aspect of his idea was that if there's a certain amount of information, as information flows, so it loses some of its quality, it suffers from entropy. Now, he came up with a mathematical formula which would enable you to determine how much slack in a network per participant to make sure that everyone got the information they needed. Now, in terms of communication engineering, those of you who are communication engineers will probably laugh at that. But that's basically, in terms of communication engineering, that lets you model how big a GSM network you can have to make sure everyone can NASA. Right? Now, that seems a perfectly reasonable engineering task, right? If the signal decays, if you get a lot of stutter, as it were, static, how much slack to let people communicate? But if you read other people that say, this is all 1940s, Norbert Wiener, his cybernetics, his theory was about information theory, so this was the idea that you could model things, information theoretically. If you read the last chapter in that seminal book, his argument was that the trouble with the 1940s, the trouble of the world came to in the 1940s, was that there was too much information. And that people's heads couldn't process all information, and therefore, what did they do? They had a world war. Now, people don't read books like Wilner's to the end. But in sociology, they very rarely read Irving Goffman to the end of Asylums, where he says asylums are good for society, whereas I've said in many sociology lectures, and so on, I assume people are saying, Goffman said asylums are bad. Well, that's they never read the last chapter. Well, no one reads the last chapter of Asylum Ethics. His theory is people are moral animals that process information, and beyond a certain limit, they can't process it. So his moral, his argument here about processing, is related to the idea of communications overload. Now, you can also pursue it now with a revival of a certain kind of approach in contemporary philosophy called embodied cognition, stuff like this. His argument is that basically you have ways of telling whether someone's telling you the truth, and that you need to be able to map that, and that's a physiological fact. Now, seems to me, don't forget my opening gambit, but we have a thing, a predilection for transforming things. And there are lots of reasons why you want to do that. One of them has to be to do with what I call it, being enthralled to a technique. For example, the technique of quantification. Communication, it seems to me, seems especially subject to this. Now, when I say enthralled to a technique, enthralled to a technique which might be hugely useful for some questions, like how to build a cellular network, might not be the same technique you'd want to use to answer other questions, like, why did my mother want me to communicate? And is it right for me to say, I go to work and suffer communications overload? Okay. Now, it seems to me communication suffers from that problem. It's easy to count. So, let's take, for example, let's have it in communication studies, a kind of, in North America, derivative of sociology from 1940s studies of communication. There are some calculus has been introduced determining communications overload. And to be precise, this guy, Desoulle Cool, came up with a technique for measuring it. And he argued that by doing a study that people process 240 words per minute. So, latterly, in the same discipline, these characters, you know, have produced a study of, well, if we know that's how many words people can process, then let's look at how people, what amount of words are coming into the modern home. So they studied newspapers, which are diminishing in the amount of words they convey and in the frequency with which they arrive in the doorstep, but also newspapers on the internet, news content on broadcast media, including radio, and calculating. And what do you think they came up with? Well, they come up with the suggestion, the claim, that we're overloaded. Now, it seems to me that this is a trap that they're thinking. One of the things I wanted to show those people and argue, the book I wrote with some colleagues 3 years ago, for the BBC, we were looking at the future of TV. And one of the things we did some ethnographic studies of what people do when they watch TV. And one of the things we discovered, and this discovery is the right word, is that for many people, when they go home at the end of the day, they turn the telly on. And when they turn the telly on, were they then consuming the words, the information that was conveyed by the telly? No, they turned the telly on so as to turn themselves off. They didn't know what they were watching. It didn't seem to have any consequences on their mind. The only thing they seemed to do was to avoid channels that irritated them. They seemed to be selecting channels which became wallpaper. In other words, the consumption which the syllable suggested happening wasn't really consumption at all. It was a way of turning yourself off. Now, it seems to me, in this particular book, that you have to be much more sensitive to what people are doing and why they're doing it before you rush to things, for example, counting content like messages. Now, here's a similar example in another book that my colleague here, Abby, and I wrote, related to the same problem. When I first came to Cambridge a few years ago, we worked in Xerox, and then there was an argument that paper would be replaced. And it would be replaced when the speed at which you could read words on an electric screen was equal to the speed at which you could read words on a paper screen. And the issues there were screen resolution, how black and white things looked, viewing angle, and so forth. And if you did studies, you could compare how quickly people read on the two. And you could show that there was a trajectory where reading on screen was going up nearly as good as paper. And on the basis of that trajectory, you could say, 1998, they should pass each other. So, seemed reasonable, sort of contention. So, what do we do? So, well, let's go and have a look at reading.
and we looked at reading in the workplace. And what we found in the Myth of Tables Office research was that there's hardly a single instance we could find in, I mean, this particular set of research, about 12, 15 different types of workers, of people reading and only reading where the target of their reading was to get to the end quickly. What we found instead, those of you who are State Librarians will understand this, when you get, someone gets a book, they don't open it and goes from beginning to end. They do all sorts of things. For example, if you're vain, like me, you see if you referenced it. So you start at the back, hypertext through it. But in addition to that, much more importantly, if you look at people in the workplace, when they're reading, they're also looking at more than one thing. They're reading this report and reading that report. And to boot, they're making notes. So, what is it you're trying to measure? Are you trying to measure just the reading of the single thing, or to measure the reading of this, to comparing to that, to the making of the notes? What we argued there was to think of reading as simply as a race, a speed problem, a processing problem, in that fashion described by De Silva Paul and other researchers, is to misunderstand what the thing is. So counting, I'm trying to suggest, appeals. You're getting enthralled to the idea. If only I could say, if I know today, I have 50 messages, instant messages, texts from my daughter, and email, therefore I'm overloaded. It sounds entrancing that you could be as simple as that. We also know that we're rushing. All of us, tonight, rushed home, quickly changed, especially after a hot, stuffy day in the office. Clean yourself off, rush up there. We're busy. And yet, this. We like messaging. We like this stuff. What are we whinging about? And yet we're entranced by it. Most of you, I would gamble, have Facebook account. Not all of you, but a lot of you. Perhaps I could ask this, those of you who don't have a Facebook account. Now, a lot of you have gone on Facebook, registered, and not been there much since, but that's a separate matter. You're willing to try.
Your counting fallacy.
Yeah. So, let's look at it a different way. Let's think of it this way. What is an act of communication? What I'm trying to suggest is that to think of it numerically might be a little bit distracting. I'm not saying sometimes you might want to do some counting, just saying be alert. Is it about the exchange of something, for example? Well, if you think of some famous old philosophers, Locke, he had the idea that it was about the exchange of something. He wrote that there's what's called the telementation pieces. The telementation pieces, so all communication is about getting something in here and telementing it into John's head. And that's the problem. And then we have all sorts of problems. We don't speak the same language, we're not in the same place, we don't understand each other. And then we have a kind of what sometimes gets called a counting quinine, a thought. Somehow a thought is kind of analogous to this telementation thing. It's in here, I need to get it somehow over there. And then we have this kind of idea. Darren Peters writes a marvellous book on communication. And he says that we have another possibility when we communicate because there's something inside us, an inner soul that's desperate to get out. Think of the Gergen I was mentioning, the kind of romantic notion of someone inside a central. And he says this is the 19th century notion derived from the invention of the telephone. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then we have things, for example, some of the current embodied cognition philosophers argue that communication is the metaphorical form of the sexual act. God, if only my daughter knew. Okay. I've suggested what, I'm thinking about time, we suggest why. Perhaps that's another way of moving from ahead. Right, an old-fashioned technology. What is this as a cultural practice? I'm looking at that because I have some photographs of letters sent from Buckingham Palace, and you wouldn't know this unless you've been doing some research, on Royal Mail. Buckingham Palace is its own postmark. So when you get a letter from someone in the house, the Royal House, presumably the current mother-in-law, as it were, but also presumably got a letter stamped with the from them. What kind of cultural practice is it? Well, a guy called Henkin, an American historian, argued that, curiously, it's a banal finding, that what is a letter? It's an epistle. Those of you who know your Latin will know what that means.
But he said much more than that, and it has certain kind of properties. He also argues in that particular book that the sense of what letters can do was cultivated on a large scale in the 19th century, particularly in North America, because of some changes in the society. One, was the Civil War, cast people asunder. Second, there was a gold rush, cast people asunder. And third, there was a discovery of affluence that led them to create and refine the art of what he calls cultural practice. And the interesting thing about his argument is that when people undertook to send letters, when they created their epistles, they were doing something particular. They were doing something, I'll use the phrase, whispered intimacies. But the whispered intimacies were not related to time, not related to place, not related to bodily presence. Something was transcendental. His argument was basically this. When someone wrote a letter and when someone received a letter, the two parties didn't feel as if they had been brought together in space and time. The two parties felt as if something magical had altered their relationship. Now, by magical, I don't necessarily mean a good thing. So here's examples of fathers, for example, writing scolding letters to errant sons, who were basically drinking and other things. But both parties felt as if something had altered in their relationship. And his suggestion is there's something transcendental in it. And it's the magic capacity of humans to create bonds beyond time and place. He goes on to say that this is the most striking thing in this particular book, is that the delight in this, the magic of this in North America, is the source of contemporary fascination with being in touch. Now, is that right? Now, I'm going to rush through to the second example, and this is an example is our own technology. Now, this particular technology, I can't remember where are we on this one, is simple technology, and we've devised the concept around the basis that people were overloaded. And one of the things they were suffering from was interruption. So we said, for example, if you're in a meeting, your phone rings, you're interrupted. Could we design a phone in such a fashion that it would allow people to know you're busy? Now, one thing you could do is set your phone up in various statuses. And we said, well, that's a little bit awkward. One of the things you do, if you look at people in a public setting or at home, is when they're conversing or when they want to have a conversation, they do something before they speak. They check to see if it's a good time to speak. What they do is, John's concentrating, so at listening, which means I can probably talk to him. Whereas I can look and see that John's actually on the phone. I can see that he's busy. In other words, you glance. So we thought we could design a phone that lets you glance. So we took, actually not one of our own products, a Nokia phone, and wrote a little application so that when you did something with it, people could glance through it to see if you were available. Now, obviously, if your phone is in your pocket and they glance through it, these are video phones, they're not going to see much. So we thought, well, how might you engineer it? We engineered it in a certain kind of way, which transformed this from being an ordinary video phone, this is fairly useless, into a glance phone. And basically, we put a little leg on the back. So now the camera's switched on, and it sits like that, so it can sit. Those you can concentrate. So it can sit like this, like a webcam. And the idea was that if you're busy, put your phone in glance phone mode so everyone can see, they can phone you up. And what would happen was, here's me, my colleague, these are the scenarios we actually used. I'm busy in a meeting, I don't want to go through my settings, I just put my phone in glance phone mode like that. People can come and they can take a glance, simple glance. Another example, I'm at home celebrating good life. These are obviously American images. I work for an American company, these are good, happy people doing happy things together. And you can see that they're busy, okay? So we had a trial around here. I can do it for the boring bit. And what did we find? Well, the first thing we found was somebody sent their glance phone home because, and I quote, he was too busy. And we said, but hold on, the whole point of this was to let you people see how busy you are. He said, no, because that's not what happens. What actually happened was something slightly different. What we found was that there would be about 1,000 actual glances were made. That there would be one glance between someone with a glance phone and another glance, and then there would be a bundle of them. And it was very different from what we expected. This sort of main difference was that...
here you go, these are the images.
We expected this. This is me desperate to be glanced at. This is me in meetings, these people all busy working, this is a visitor, so I'm glancing. Very little of that, but what we did have was lots of this. Now, what are these people doing? This is my colleague at the top left.
Dossing. And why is there a dance? Because what he did was, he had done his work for a paper and left it on my desk, went home, and at 8 o'clock, he got me to glance in to see what he was doing, because he knew I was working, and he knew I would glance and see that he wasn't working. And this was another colleague, supposed to be working at a conference. She wanted us to glance at her because she wasn't really working. What do you do at conferences? You have a pint of beer. Now, how did she manage to do this? What happened in practice was that people discovered that with glance phones, you could phone someone up to a normal phone, or the way we wrote the application, you could select a glance. And if the glance phone you glanced at was closed and not glance phone mode, you couldn't glance. But the person who had the phone would say, Richard tried to glance. What people discovered was that you could make a summons, which is, I'm going to try and glance you, because what I really want you to do is glance at me. And this is how this worked, that people were getting other people to glance at them. So what was the moral of this? People were doing things because things were worth glancing at. What they were doing, what they were not doing, who they were with, where they were, and so forth. The bottom line here is, our technology didn't solve interruption. You could say that it was a failure, but that would be completely missing the point. The point about the technology was that it enabled people to create new ways of keeping in touch, new ways of breaking that bond. And then in this particular instance, gave it new kind of forms, things like laughter, things like mockery, like things like, look at me, so you can better understand why I'm laughing at you. This was creating stuff to communicate, manufacturing stuff to communicate. Now, I won't talk about this one because I'm worried about time. So, what I wanted to sort of move towards, and none at the end of my comment, the question's better put this way. What is it when people, what are they doing when they send a letter? Someone advanced an example. These sorts of things help us a little bit, but not much. And the real problem, this is, and it's also from around here, it's dead, Wittgenstein. I think we have an incredibly rich set of understandings, and I use the word banal up front, to do with how we communicate and why we communicate. And vast sets of diversities. And one of the problems we have is rushing to concepts like counting, our overload. Well, we are overloaded, but what kinds of things are we overloaded about? These things we communicate for all sorts of reasons. To tell someone something, show affection. Well, let's take the example of showing affection. I've mentioned her a few times, 17-year-old. When she was 6, she loved cuddles. She couldn't get enough cuddles. If I touched my daughter now, she would bristle with resentment. Okay? So, my wife, meanwhile, sitting in the audience, if I kissed her, she'd be very pleased. If I kissed her 3 times, she'd be thinking, what's he done? In other words,
what's he smoking?
The point I'm trying to suggest is that each of these acts is understood by us ordinarily in different sorts of ways. And sometimes quantification, measuring, counting does matter. How often are you courteous to others? Well, some colleagues I'm courteous with all the time. I go, they're never, ever courteous to me, but still I do. And sometimes we do these things because we're obliged to. Sometimes different measures matter. And you can think about these things as creating different sorts of bonds. Right, at work, I've been rather critical about Weiner, other information theorists. But actually, what are you doing at work? You're doing information production, you're exchanging information. These are different bonds in the bonds of other things, like bonds of play. All these different kinds of things, being together, different sorts of criteria and explanations. And if you juxtapose those, as I do here, I'm rushing now, I'm thinking about times. Passing the time of day, the bond of presence, just chatting. I did it with my neighbours tonight because we had a lightning strike on the street. I don't know these dudes, but I passed the time of day with them. I made a story, I communicated, yeah? Too much, too little. I don't read them. So, that's the moral. What I try to suggest is, weirdly, that we have a texture to human emotions, but different channels for different sorts of things. And my suggestion is that we rush to simple explanations about these sorts of things, rush ahead, and neglect the kinds of bonds that are afforded by different sorts of channels. Some channels and some affordances do irritate. So you feel like saying texting, the value of an SMS is that it arrives. It's a whisper. It's intimate.
That's its value. That's why it's all the more vexing when a boss sends you a text, like, for God's sake, why are you in my pocket? A written letter. What's the genius of a written letter? Even on the Archers recently, those of you listening, there was a suggestion that someone write a letter. And she replied, I don't write letters. And the other person said, look, when you write a letter, what you do is you don't splurge. One of the geniuses of the written letter, my last point, is that you can time travel. And what do I mean by that? When you write a sentence, it doesn't matter whether it's pen or a keyboard, if you get it wrong, you can go back to the beginning again. When you leave a voice message, for example, you can't undo it. When you speak to someone in real time and you said it, you can't unsay it. You can say, I didn't mean it, but they know you said it, they heard you, you know that they know that you heard so. But with a written letter, you can time travel. You can go to the end of where you wanted to be and say, that's not where I want to be. You can delete it, quickly put it in the bin, tear it up in case someone picks it up, and go to the beginning again. So there's certain things you can do with it. Voice calls, the very preciousness of them is that they're tantalising. You can get it wrong. You can say the wrong thing. So there's different sorts of experiences. It's important that you realise that one is not less than another. They're different. And there's a problem with texting. For God's sake, how many of our loves users have been saying texts from boyfriends and no longer boyfriends? But they're kind of really violent. Letters have other properties. Voice. I could go on talking much more about these sorts of things. So, do we communicate too much? You tell me. My theory is this. More, what this curmudgeonly Oxford philosopher says, look, we have loads of categories for using and understanding the way we do our life. We don't need science, we just need reason. We don't need Don Norman's contemporary thinking about the human mind as being an information processor. We do for some questions, but for the question as to why we communicate, just think about why you communicate in this instance, in that instance. What are you trying to achieve? And are you achieving it in such a fashion which is defensive because it's too much? Or are you achieving it and offending people because it's too little? Sometimes they are the right answers. Oftentimes they're not. But perhaps most interesting, most of all, is we don't actually communicate a great deal if you think about the amount of time we spend, for example, in bed, travelling to and from work, and listening to other people give lectures. Thank you.
Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions, objections, compliments? Or any of the above?
When you receive a lot more communication, I think, than we did in the past, would that be fair? Even though we may spend less time creating it ourselves? I'm thinking about broadcast media, basically. And when I'm driving, I'm not communicating, but I may well be listening to the radio. And how does that sort of fit in? Is communication two-way?
I agree. I mean, one of the things you could say, take the workplace, you could say that what email about is not about information exchange. It's mostly about people at work chatting to each other. And one of the things you find about people chatting is that they deepen their bonds by chatting more. But that also means some people say, for God's sake, you stop it, just get on with some work. Well, no, they come to work to chat. And weirdly, they're sitting in the PC beside you, they're emailing you. They're just chatting. So if you're thinking about just chatting, is it the case people chat too much? Is it the case that technology will let them chat too much? Absolutely. Is it the technology's fault? Is it communications overload? Well, it's people talking, like people chatting. Do people chat too much? That seems severe to say that people at work are chatting too much. What kind of frigid person would you be to say to colleagues that you talk too much? Well, you know, I mean, that's the logic of it. Now, likewise, you my daughter, she is using Instant Messenger on BlackBerry, and the delight of that is that when she turns the account off, it's gone. So whatever she said is not there for recording, whilst on her Facebook, the stuff is there to be taken and made visible. And yet, what she's actually doing is she's Facebooking and BlackBerrying, and I thought I was saying, how can you possibly how can you communicate? Because she says, well, I'm doing different sorts of things. And I say to her, well, why don't you have video? If you're so close to your friends, why don't you have free Skype calls? She said, no, I don't want to see my friends. I want to write to my friends. I want to say what I think I mean. I don't want them to see me because that might throw me off. They might see the wrong thing. Oh, so what are you doing? So I'm just talking to them with words. I like to write. And is there too much?
as an adult, going into a living room home, I think, whoa, but then she's a teenager. What does teenagers do? Teenagers have these febrile existences where lots of small communications with the same gang of people continuously, ad infinitum, about apparently nothing, is what teenagers do. I'm sure when you were 17, there was a lot hanging around somewhere or another talking about the future of technology, right? Now, was your old man and your old lady saying, why can't he get on and do his homework? Well, they're big teenagers, right? So we complain about teenagers having this sort of existence and being appalled by it. But hold on, they're teenagers. Now, yes, do they do it too much? Well, I'm a parent, of course I say that. It's not as easy as it seems. And do we communicate? Do we have too many channels? Do we have too much? Well, yeah, but what are you talking about?
Richard, did you look at gender differences? Yeah. Received wisdom is that women are more verbal, more interested in connectivity than men.
Yes.
But one of the things you said, which really struck me, you said that you receive, it's so intimate to receive a text message in your pocket.
Yes.
I thought, my God, it is. All I ever get is a text message in my handbag.
It is different. But hold on, does a man put his hand in your handbag very often? No, the point being is, it's still an intimate place. Is there a gender difference? I'm sure there are. One of the curious things is that you find, that hasn't been a theme, but one of the things that we did bump into was a remarkable aversion to voice messaging amongst women. And it seems to be because they want to get it right. And this is the thing about time travel, it's more difficult to get it right, whereas men just bumble. Oh, I didn't really mean that. In other words, they can happily get their kind of cock it up and try and make amends, but the women want to, better word, get it right straight away. And if it's difficult, they avoid the mess, they avoid the channel and go another sort of way. Okay. So those sorts of examples. I'm sure there will be other examples, especially with the taking of new channels now, for example, Skype, as a way of doing family tendencies. And through seeing children, through seeing relatives, and that, which I think might be gender, but that wasn't really stepping into.
One of the things that struck me as you were talking and reading the book as well was that there's an awful lot of moral panic about technology always, and this kind of panic about overload and the rest of it seems to me to be part of a kind of a trend that's been going on for as long as we've had communication technologies, in the sense that there's always a feeling that the new technology destroys something. You know, it's a bit like your mother and the golden age of letter writing. And it goes back to Plato, the argument about writing. The hilarious assertions made by parents in the 50s when I was a kid, that these are people who kept the television set on all the time in their houses, but then complained that it ruined the art of communication, art of conversation, and so on and so on. So that what you've been looking at and dissecting is kind of just the latest example of another one of these moral panics.
Yeah, but I think these moral panics sometimes have reason for it. So one of the things we did in our report in the last chapter is studies of older people. Older people post 65, say. And the claim, in this instance particularly, is by the mobile operators and the manufacturers of the mobile phone operating systems, that old people don't use technology, don't want to communicate. So you go and talk to them, and they say, oh, you work for Microsoft. No, don't communicate. Don't use that modern stuff. Don't communicate. And you gradually talk to them. It turns out that they do like to write letters occasionally. Not often, but occasionally. So you say, well, why do you write letters? What's the value of letters? He said, because I love that person, and I love them enough that I will give them an hour. My grandson won't even give me 5 minutes. What kind of relationship is that? I don't want to be in a world where all I give to those I love is 1 minute. That's not love. I love someone enough to give them an hour. I expect them to love me back by reading it. And I also expect that they don't send back a letter on return, because that shows lack of thoughtfulness, reflection, and gradual investment. So the old people we talked to did want to communicate, but they had a really severe notion of why you communicate, which was devotional. Whereas you talk to the teenagers, and what they want to seem to be doing, they just want to prattle. But for them, that's love of their own kind. Is one better than another? Well, it's certainly clear that people have strong opinions. I'm shocked at how fragmented my teenage daughter's life is. But then she's shocked at the fact that I would write a book. Because how could you be so interested in something for so long? What kind of person can you be to be so boring? Right? So, you know.
Emma, and then.
As an oldie, I
chatting, hi, it's me again, that sort of thing. Those are the two impressions I have.
Well, actually, I know. I think you hit on two important properties, which is that the handwritten letter, although it might be slow and ponderous, it's sensual in the ways that the keyboard doesn't allow you to be sensual. But he also has other sorts of properties. Because there's only one of it, for it to be shared means someone's had to put effort into copying it. Whereas in an email, it's easy to forward. So one consequence of that is that they have just sort of properties. But one of the things I also think you were pointing out was people don't know what the genre are. So, but you look at, say, youngsters, and one of the things they say, only old people have email. And they think of old people having email because they're work. And they think of email as a work thing. And it's formal. It's, dear Richard, thank you very much. I look forward to working with you. Whereas they're saying, well, when I get... again, my daughter, she says, well, when I get a job, I'll have to have email. Because that's what you do at work, right? But her idea is it's a genre thing, that it's the formal letter. But people say, like yourself and like me, I also use email for personal things. But it doesn't have any of the central apparatus that I would like. And some of the constraints, like... It seems weird that I send long letters. My long letters can be forwarded. It seems weird, but it seems also a bit creepy to put one of these little flags on it, which allows you to prohibits forwarding, because that suddenly seems as if you're a bit uptight. So you have technologies which are not letting you do some things, and then if they do things, you distort the meaning of it. And what I think you've pointed towards is that there's fantastic richness in the ways we could express and can express. And we sometimes muddle with new technologies. And one of the problems we have is we have electric woks when actually what we want is a flat frying pan.
That problem arises in organisational context as well. For example, in the John Lewis Partnership, which is a vast organisation, there was, in the days of handwritten memos, only one person in the organisation, the chief executive or the leading partner, whatever it was called, only one person in that organisation was allowed to write in green ink. So if you got a handwritten message from the chief executive, it was in green ink. And when they went over to email, terrible problem. What are they going to do? And actually, I think the solution was that their email system was configured so that his messages always came in green.
Okay, can we finish? Because I'm getting flaggy. The long and short of it is that I hope you all go home and go into your lives and say, I want new channels, I want new media. If they let me do things like be more sensual, or like get things into my back pocket, or into my handbag, or however. But, and that's why I think I'd like to try and invent new things, because I don't think we got it right. We're constrained, and we don't understand why other people might be celebrating the new channels. Like, why is a teenager's like to prattle? Well, the reason why we disdain that is because we forget what it's like to be a teenager. But we also shouldn't forget what the old people that I interview also appreciate, and we've, in my generation, kind of lost. When I walked out the door, I have never written to my mother.
Oh,
isn't that terrible?
Emma, do you want to have... sorry, I missed out your question.
I had a question, but I might pounce on you later if you're going to be there for the question.
Yes, I'm just unflagging a bit.
Yeah, okay. Right. Okay, listen, thank you very much, Richard. Let's... I'll send you a handwritten letter of thanks. please help yourself to another drink, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.